Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Shares in mortgage giant Countrywide slid 39% earlier this week. Seems shareholders aren't exactly pleased with all those subprime foreclosures. That is, till today, when the company's stock posted a whopping gain of 51%, $2.63, all on word of a possible buyout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by LendingTree, where you can choose up to four customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 10th day of January. Several reports out today say Bank of America is in, quote, advanced talks to buy Countrywide Financial, the nation's largest mortgage lender. A buyout, first reported by the Wall Street Journal, would be yet another signal that Bank of America sees something in Countrywide that others don't. B of A already injected $2 billion into the mortgage company back in August as the subprime credit crunch hit. But just this week, Countrywide's stock plummeted on renewed rumors that it might be on the verge of bankruptcy. The company says foreclosures and late payments on its mortgages hit record highs in December. So we asked Chris Thornburg of Beacon Economics what the attraction might be for B of A.
They're looking out into the future. They think there's a high likelihood of Countrywide going bankrupt. And so they sort of have a choice at this point in time. Do you want to become a creditor later on or just move in right now and take over the organization?
Countrywide lost $1.2 billion in the third quarter of last year. It has stopped selling subprime loans but still holds hundreds of thousands of mortgages and bank deposits. Thornburg says a buyout would have minimal effect on Countrywide customers. Bank of America and Countrywide have not returned our calls. The Journal reported a deal could be announced soon. We heard ad nauseum in December about how it was a bad holiday season for retailers. Well, today, sales numbers proved it. Any sort of consumer spending slowdown raises the pressure on the Fed to lower short-term interest rates to avoid a recession. During a speech in Washington today, Chairman Ben Bernanke indicated another rate cut may be in the offing. John Dimsdale reports.
Forecasters at most big Wall Street investment banks say the economy is probably in a recession. Many criticize the Fed for not aggressively cutting interest rates to jumpstart the sputtering economy. Today, Chairman Bernanke pointed out the Fed has already cut rates by a percentage point over the last 4 months.
The Federal Reserve is not currently forecasting a recession. We are forecasting slow growth. But we, as I mentioned today, there are downside risks, and therefore it's very important for us to stand ready, as I mentioned, to take substantive action.
The prospect that substantive action means lower interest rates caused at least a temporary uptick in the stock market. But Fed watcher David Jones says Bernanke's reputation is that he's not a take-charge chairman.
I think the markets want a strong Fed leader, wants him to be authoritarian, as former Fed Chairman Greenspan was, and particularly in dealing with this credit crisis, which in fact has led us into a recession. It may be okay to give the Fed as an organization greater power and to depersonalize the chairmanship in normal times. These are not normal times.
However, another Fed watcher, Bank of America's Mickey Levy, likes a more democratic Fed, and he thinks the members have interest rates just about right.
They're keeping themselves firmly grounded and trying to alert the market that their long-run objective is still low inflation. So I give Bernanke high marks.
The Fed's next meeting is less than 3 weeks away. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Stocks did push higher today for the second day in a row. The gains come amid much gloom on Wall Street. The Standard & Poor's index of the nation's largest 500 companies is already off 3% for the year. But today, stock analysts predicted that those same companies which showed double-digit profit growth in 2008. Who's right? Here's our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barchet.
On Wall Street, analysts and investors are kind of like farmers and cowboys. They just can't be friends. Michael Thompson is director of research at Thompson Financial. He tracks thousands of stock analysts and their forecasts for all 500 stocks of the S&P. He says stock analysts are expecting corporate profits to rise 16% this year.
Overseas, there's been tremendous economic growth. Companies have just gotten far more efficient. There's also been put in place over the last several years practices which have really taken companies to a new level of competitive agility.
If the analysts are right, investors should be bidding stocks up, up, up. They're not. Thompson says investors are trading on emotions rather than company fundamentals. Al Goldman scoffs at that idea. He's the chief market strategist at AG Edwards. Goldman says the market is dominated by professional investors who know what they're doing.
So I think the market is right far more often than analysts are. I think the market is saying the risk of a recession is up.
Goldman says stock analysts aren't aware of how much damage a recession will do.
Sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees. I think some people forget to look beyond the end of their noses and say, okay, I like this company, I like the management, I like their long-term plans, but what about the outlook for the whole economy?
One more thing to consider. Analysts may be projecting double-digit growth, but that doesn't amount to much after most companies' disappointing performance in 2007. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
The leading Republican presidential candidates are in South Carolina for a debate tonight. That state makes its choice for a nominee a week from Saturday. Michigan holds its primaries next Tuesday. And these Republican candidates are starting to notice something on the minds of voters other than national security, the economy. Jeremy Hobson reports.
New Hampshire has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the nation. Michigan has the highest. It's a must-win state for Mitt Romney, who said this yesterday in Grand Rapids.
Michigan's one-state recession will come to an end if I'm president.
Rudy Giuliani is staking his political future on a win in Florida's primary. Foreclosures have hit that state hard. Here's the ad he debuted there today.
With pundits handicapping the campaign like the Super Bowl, it's easy to lose sight of what's at stake. An economy in peril.
Speaking of peril, John McCain is talking about aid for those who have lost their jobs in Michigan, and Mike Huckabee is talking about the downsides of free trade.
It does have a much more populist feel than what you usually hear.
That's Chuck Cushman at the George Washington University School of Political Management. He says Republicans are worried by record Democratic turnout in the early states and need to show they feel voters' economic pain. For Republican voter Lori Olson in Punta Gorda, Florida, the shift is welcome. I asked her if GOP candidates have focused enough on the economy until now.
No, I don't think they have. And I think too many special interests are keeping it focused away from the economy.
And since the GOP controls the White House, says Chuck Cushman, it's especially important for Republican candidates to acknowledge economic distress.
The party in power when the recession starts is the one that gets in trouble at the next election.
In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, as we mentioned, Countrywide and Ben Bernanke led the way up. Details when we do the numbers. Big Apple has added itself to the list of cities trying to rid themselves of the scourge of plastic grocery bags. The city council passed legislation this week requiring big grocery stores and other retailers to provide recycling bins for all those bags. Earlier this week, China announced it's banning the bags. So perhaps the catchphrase paper or plastic will morph into paper, or do you have your own? If you don't, most stores will sell you one. Reusable grocery bags are becoming big business. Vincent Cobb is the president and founder of ReusableBags.com. And let me ask you first, what kind of bag do you use?
Well, personally, I carry with me kind of every day is an ultra-compact reusable shopping bag. It's one of the ones that we produced. And this is a bag that's tiny, can fit inside of my pocket or my backpack, and I can use it to avoid accumulating all those plastic bags when we're out running errands.
All right. Well, this obviously is a market that has grown exponentially for you over the last several years. How is the company doing?
The company's doing great. The site went live in 2003, and it kind of exploded in the past year to year and a half, especially in the United States, because globally lots of things have been happening with the plastic bag issue, but it really kind of hit the radar in the United States in the past 18 months or so.
How has the reusable industry evolved?
To a certain extent, all the mousetraps have been developed. Like, mm-hmm. we don't need to figure out a better mousetrap for reusable shopping bags.
Right.
But it's amazing. I mean, there's a lot of, like any time with this, there's a lot of junky products and there are a lot of really good products that have been developed. What we're going to start seeing now is, you know, the shakeout. The good ones are going to start taking off in the marketplace and the bad ones are going to go by the wayside, hopefully.
Yeah, and you know, it seems like we've gotten to the point where these bags are almost a fashion statement. I wonder if you expect to see some competition from the likes of, you know, Prada and Coach.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the way I look at this whole thing, there's been a big trendiness that's, you know, the awareness happened in the past, like earlier in 2007, and it already became trendy with $1,000 reusable shopping bags popping up out there. So we think the smart place for the average consumer is to land someplace in the middle, get a handful of good reusable shopping bags that you're actually going to use. Don't accumulate a bunch in your closet or have impractical, you know, $500 ones.
This obviously has been, for the most part, an environmental issue. Is it possible to calculate the economic cost of plastic bags?
I mean, there's natural resource consumption because this is a consumable. And so it's natural gas or petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the cost to the environment, which is really hard to calculate. Since the numbers are so staggering, we're talking about billions that are in the environment every year, and they don't biodegrade, as sometimes it's kind of this misinformation that gets out there. They photodegrade, which means they break into smaller and smaller bits. Those polymers will exist in our environment forever. And on the flip side, from an industry standpoint, I mean, this is a multi-billion dollar industry for the companies that are producing plastic bags. So it's kind of a high-stakes game all around. It seems like it's a minor thing, but it's the volume in which these are produced and consumed that makes it actually not a minor thing. I think it's a pretty substantial thing.
Vincent Cobb is the president and founder of ReusableBags.com. They're based in Chicago. Vincent, I guess I will thank you for allowing us to put this interview in the bag.
Great. Nice talking to you today.
Everything's up to date in Kansas City, so the song says. That is certainly true as far as electronic trading networks are concerned. You've heard of the big boys, the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange. But in Kansas City, an upstart network equipped with even more up-to-date technology is gaining ground on the big players. In just a year, it's become the third largest market center in the U.S. This week, Deutsche Bank and J.P. Morgan said they are both buying in. From KCUR in Kansas City, Sylvia Maria Gross reports.
Mention the words electronic trading system, and most people think of the first and the biggest, NASDAQ. The exchange opened in 1971, and it's stayed on top ever since. But there's a problem with being a front runner. Complacency can set in.
The street was looking for alternatives, and so we filled that gap.
That's Joe Ratterman. He's CEO of a small exchange called the Better Alternative Trading System, or BATS. BATS is based in Kansas City, 1,000 miles from Manhattan. But in just 1 year, it's managed to poach 9% of the market. Today, it's the third biggest stock exchange in the U.S., after NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange. Ratterman says that BATS system is newer than its competitors, and it's faster. He says the exchange can execute a trade in as fast as 500 microseconds.
It's not a time that the human brain can even comprehend.
But even more than technology, exchanges need shares, lots of them. Matthew Simon's an analyst at Tab Group, which tracks electronic exchanges.
Success is measured by the number of shares and the volume that you can attract to your venue. And in that sense, BATS has been able to reach near double-digit figures in terms of their matched market share.
BATS did it by launching what it called the January Special, paying brokers more to sell their shares than it charged to buy. Most exchanges do the reverse. The special discount cost BATS millions of dollars, but Simon says it opened the floodgates and the shares flowed in.
It was, at the time, a very extreme, radical way to get liquidity to their venue. and it seemed to have panned out well for them since their volume increased by nearly twofold by the end of the month.
At first, the big exchanges laughed at BAT's tactics, recalls CEO Joe Ratterman.
A lot of people thought going into it that it was a crazy idea, and what will happen is at the end of the month, the volumes won't stick, so you'll have given away a lot of money and not really gained anything.
But before long, NASDAQ and the NYSE were scrambling to lower their prices, too. They couldn't hold BATs back. Trading volume at the exchange powered higher over most of 2007. It eventually hit 840 million shares a day, and BATS employees ate a lot of ice cream.
We like to buy ice cream as frequently as possible whenever we hit new volume milestones.
And the money poured in from big investors like Citigroup, Credit Suisse, and Merrill Lynch. In November, BATS applied to the Securities and Exchange Commission to become the 11th official stock exchange in the U.S. Matthew Simon at Tab Group says that could slow the company down a little.
By being a major U.S. exchange, you obviously have more expenses in order to run your operations, and you also then would probably have a little bit less flexibility in your pricing.
It could take between 2 and 5 years before the SEC gives BATS the green light, CEO Joe Ratterman says. But rather than cooling his heels in Kansas City, he says he's thinking about making a move on Europe. In Kansas City, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross for Marketplace.
Coming up, compensation claims multiply in Iraq.
The majority of them are deaths. Family members have been shot by coalition forces or insurgents, and they're looking for money out of that.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks tracked higher today on that Bank of America countrywide news and word that the Fed is ready to cut rates again. The Dow rose 117 points, 0.9%, to close at 12,853. The NASDAQ picked up 0.5%, 13 points, to end at 2488. And the S&P 500 climbed 1.2%, 17 points, to finish the day at 1426. Countrywide's shares, as we mentioned, scorched higher on that takeover chatter. It ended the day up 51%. Bank of America's stock rose 1.4%. The rate cut news sparked a rally in other financials. Citigroup bumped up 2.25%, and both Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan pushed up 2.75%. You are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for November. It's the sixth anniversary of the arrival of the first prisoners at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Amnesty International is planning protest events around the world. And on January 11, 1964, the U.S. Surgeon General issued the first report stating that smoking may be hazardous to your health. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is that time of year when high school seniors keep their fingers and toes crossed 24/7, awaiting the arrival, hopefully, of a fat envelope from their college of choice. The sticker shock won't set in until bills start to arrive. But several universities recently announced big increases in financial aid. Commentator Kim Clark says it looks like things may be starting to turn in students' favor.
Colleges insist they've had to raise their prices because they've absorbed new costs like counseling, remedial classes, and technology, while governments have cut support. But there's also another factor. They've been raising prices because they could. In the past decade, the number of high school seniors has risen by 500,000, increasing demand. And then there's the Chivas Regal effect. That's consumers' assumption that things with higher prices must be more desirable. It works for whiskey and colleges. Back in 2000, Clemson, the public university in South Carolina, collected fewer than 10,000 applications a year and charged less than $5,000 in tuition. Then the school decided to raise its profile and prices. It more than doubled tuition and spent more money on things like financial aid and top professors. Applications have jumped more than 50%. But no tree grows to the sky. In fact, even the best colleges may soon see applications drop. A baby bust in the early 1990s means the number of high school seniors is about to decline. And maybe private colleges, which now cost more than $50,000 a year, have finally reached the limits of the Chivas Regal effect. In the last several weeks, the competition seems to have switched from how much to how little colleges can charge. Harvard made a splash by promising to charge no more than 10% of the income of families earning up to $180,000 a year. That was followed by promises of more aid from several other expensive schools, including Swarthmore, Pomona, and Tufts. California Lutheran University, for example, recently promised to match the tuition of UCLA for students who get into both schools. What's that? Matching a lower price? That sure sounds like an old-fashioned price war. If so, that's something every parent can celebrate. It might even be worth breaking out that Chivas Regal.
Kim Clark covers money for U.S. News and World Report. Have a plan to finance your kids' education? Tell us about it. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. U.S. warplanes dropped 40,000 pounds of bombs in a matter of minutes today in an area on the outskirts of Baghdad, believed to be a haven for several al-Qaeda groups. It's part of a nationwide offensive that U.S. forces announced this week. The targets may be insurgents, but inevitably, property is damaged and innocent civilians get killed. Once the gunfire stops, military officials move in to make some kind of restitution for accidental damage and death. As Adam Allington reports from Ramadi, it can be a tough call.
At a desolate Iraqi police station on the outskirts of Ramadi, three U.S. Army Civil Affairs soldiers set up a laptop in a cold, dusty room. A line of people form outside. The soldiers review compensation claims from Iraqi civilians against coalition forces. The stories of destruction and loss may be true, but Sergeant First Class Michael Blanford says arriving at any concrete fact is often a Byzantine and frustrating experience.
How old is he? He's 16.
Well, tell him on that file that he's got right there.
He was born in 1988.
Well, on here it says he's born in 1969.
Oh, my God.
I'm looking for those core things so that I can go back into military records and go, okay, did this actually occur? Most of the time, you're going to get your basic information of who they are, and you'll get like a short paragraph of the U.S. forces drove a tank over my front yard and knocked down my wall, and that'll be it. It won't have a date. It will not be a clear package 90% of the time.
It's up to Blanford's team and a translator to piece these stories together. He says the payments aren't an admission of guilt. In most cases, it's just something to help a bad situation.
That door would be worth like $50. If Coalition came in and searched this and kicked this door in, we'd reimburse them $50 to replace that door.
How much for a cow? How much for a sheep?
I think a cow was like $300, and then the sheeps were almost anywhere under $100.
Cows and sheep are one thing, but the hardest cases these soldiers deal with involve human lives, and they make up the vast majority of claims.
How much for a human life?
The maximum paid is $2,500. So that's what it'll be for a death. It'll be the maximum is $2,500.
Of the claims that I witnessed, some included killed livestock, a cracked window. One man even said the U.S. Army had taken his rocks. But the most perplexing were the deaths. Almost no one could provide even the most basic information, such as dates or cause of death. Staff Sergeant Joseph Miller also works for Army Civil Affairs.
A typical situation, we get a lot of the majority of them are deaths. Family members have been shot by coalition forces or insurgents, and they're looking for money out of that.
Miller says there's often confusion about what kinds of death merit compensation.
Most of them are denied. If anything occurs by insurgents, that's not something we can control. That's not something we pay for.
Her husband is working for the Americans. He's driving a tanker vehicle. And at that time, the insurgents just like killed him because he's working for America at that time. And she's claiming now, she say she got the little son here, and then they have nothing to provide for their food. So
we can't pay for what the insurgents did.
Blanford says people will often take claims from one review board to the next, trying to double-dip compensation payments. He says despite the fact that he knows many people are trying to game the system, he thinks the same thing would probably happen in most poor American cities.
You know, if there was somebody that would pull up and start giving out money for situations that happened, you would have a lot of people that would come in there and try to get some kind of funds. They would try to figure out what the system is and how to actually maneuver through that system to get to their ends.
Staff Sergeant Miller has only been in Ramadi just shy of 1 month.
The first couple I had to deal with were, they were tough. It was kind of sobering to listen to these stories. After that, you realize that some of these people have made up the story. So a lot of what we get is just, it's bogus claims. But I guess it goes back, there's always a cost to war. And for them, this is their cost.
According to the most recent figures from the General Accounting Office, the U.S. military has paid over $30 million in compensation payments in Iraq and Afghanistan. In Ramadi, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if you're a fan of HBO's The Wire, like I am, you know wiretaps cost lots of money, sometimes too much. Just like in the real world, if you can't pay the phone bill, those wiretaps go away. Well, a Justice Department audit released today shows the FBI isn't paying its bills on time, so telephone companies have cut off its wiretaps. More than half of the 990 bills sent to 5 unidentified FBI field offices were not paid on time. I'm sure officers Bunk and McNulty would have something to say about that. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 117 points, 0.9%. The Nasdaq added 13 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 rose 17 points, 1.2%. Our editors include Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, paid sick days give companies a headache.
The paid sick mandate would just be another cost, would be piling on, if you will, to these existing costs that add to a poor business climate in these states.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.